attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today, I've caught Andrew Jolliffe. For 25 years, he's written ads, strategies, thought starters, content manifestos, and copy. Some of those have won him prizes in Cannes, Paris, and New York, but more importantly, he still adores writing them. In an age where concepts cast shadows over it, Andrew is a true advocate of craft. Rory Sutherland says he's as charming, incisive, and intelligent as the work he produces, two things not always found in combination. And when a copywriter of the caliber of George Tannenbaum says things like, "I sure as hell don't want to compete against Andrew," that speaks volumes. Andrew says consumers aren't thick. They need fun, entertaining, intelligent reasons to act or change their ways, let alone buy anything. We must be craftspeople again. Craft is about caring, about treating consumers as intelligent beings, not numbers or plankton. An amoeba can tell you that sloppy work says a brand doesn't give a fuck. Craft is an investment. It shows the world you're going to be about for a long time. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Hello, and thank you very much for having me.
Seven quickfires, Andrew. Stick or twist?
Oh, goodness. Twist, because I like martinis and like a twist of lemon.
Well, sticking with that theme, wine, French or Italian?
Beg, it depends where I am, really. If I'm in France, I'll drink French. If Italian, I will not touch French. I will drink Italian. I'm very loyal to the countries I live in.
Good man. Right, pipe organ builder or firework technician?
Goodness, I've been both, so it's been both been fun. I shall expand on those two later. But they've both been a lot of fun. They've both been useful. If I have to ever go back to a career, if I want to sort of finish my working life as a way on the way I started, that I'll be a pipe organ builder again. But that might not happen.
Similar theme: beekeeping or glass blowing.
Oh, goodness. I want to go back to beekeeping again one day. So beekeeping, please.
Lovely. Number five, Will Audrey or Patrick Collister?
Oh, my God. there's a curveball. They've both been very instrumental in my career. I love them both very dearly, and they've both enormously helpful. I probably have more lunches with Will Audrey and more chat with Patrick Collister. So sometimes I see Will Audrey more through an alcoholic haze than I do Patrick Collister. Make your mind up on that one.
Right, number six, Cannes Lion or BAFTA?
BAFTA by a long way, really. Cannes Lions, I think probably one or two people have probably told you by now. I think awards themselves as a whole are losing their value because there are too many of them and the sort of criteria for winning them is changing too much. A BAFTA, yes. I mean, still, you had to work hard to be a BAFTA. I'm very lucky. I have one, which is very interesting. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well said.
But it holds more value with me than advertising awards these days. There are too many.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't blame you whatsoever. Well, finally, there's some brilliant quotes about you from other people on your website. So I'm going to put two to you and ask what your favorite, which your favorite is. There are few people who can see the world so differently, or Andrew never gets it right, and that is precisely what we appreciate about him.
The second one by a long way, really.
Yes.
Because I think the way to succeed in life, if you're in a business like ours, is to be free to fuck up. And you got to give who you write. If you're writing for a client, or you're writing for an agency, or writing for anyone, really, you've got to be prepared to give what's in your head rather than what you think they're going to expect. And if people have to understand that, really. People don't expect perfection first time. People want to see what you think. And then you refine later. So yes, indeed. Second one by a long, long, long way.
Amazing. Well, listen, That was brilliant. I was rather hoping you would choose that one, and maybe we'll expand on that as we record.
Absolutely, by all means, absolutely, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I love it as a quote as well. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, we've got one on our site, which is "Gasp is too revolutionary for the Church of England," and that was given to us by the Church of England. So we're
fantastic.
Pretty happy with
it. Very, very good. Excellent. I love it. That's exactly.
So regular listeners to the show, there are literally hundreds of thousands of them listening, will be familiar that we always like to ask our guests how their career started and how they ended up where they are now. What listeners won't know is that I have a significant amount of research just answering that question on you. And I feel like I could ask you this question and just sit back for the entire hour-long-ish episode we're going to record. So can you just talk to us a little bit about your early life and your early kind of career?
Yes, of course. Yes, I'll keep it short if I can.
Sure.
Advertising is my third career, but by far the longest. I've been in advertising now, actually, over 30 years. I left school at 16, and I thought I really knew what I wanted to be. I'd left school, but I wasn't very good at it. So I was terrible at school. But when I was 14, I built a pipe organ in my bedroom because I thought it would just be fun to do, okay? So when I was 16, I got myself an apprenticeship in London. With a firm of organ builders. And they'd just finished the organ at St. Paul's Cathedral, which is one of the biggest organs in England. And they had lots and lots of work. And it literally took us everywhere. And I did 7 years with them as an apprentice and then as an organ builder. I specialized in tuning them and maintaining them and also making the pipes as well. But also it taught me an awful lot about also the people, the extraordinary people you met. Remember, this was the 70s. It wasn't today. It wasn't very. There was nothing PC about 70s England. People said what they thought. The air was blue with four-letter words. My initiation ceremony when I first got there as an apprentice was having a liter of hot glue poured down my pants, and the foreman had the biggest porn stash I've ever seen in my life. And everything else. It was a collection of Cockney characters because it was in the east end of London in Bethnal Green, and it taught me more. It taught me as much about sort of how people work and how people tick and stuff than how to handle a plane or solder a bit of metal. Yeah, you know? It was sort of the most bizarre characters. There was a guy there who looked as if he was made out of plastic, but in fact he wasn't. And he was one of the brightest guys I've ever met. There was a guy who'd done time inside. There was a guy who sort of walked for 30 miles to work, you know. And kind of, there was a lot of people doing a lot of things that would never do now, you know. And people saw their light, you know. I wasn't called Andrew. I was called Longshanks or the Great Streak of Piss. And this was about when I was 16, and it was very, and that sort of atmosphere was really formative, you know. I graduated from being an apprentice and sweeping the floor and then making the tea to being on the bench and then went and made metal pipes and that sort of thing. But also we had one of our jobs about 3 years in was getting the organ ready for the organ in St. Paul's, ready for Charles and Di's wedding. And I worked in the cathedral for a whole week of nights. Because the organ has about 10,000 pipes, so
wow.
Me and a mate were just there all night. All night for five days, doing all that. You know, poor old Di. You know, she. You know, that I really feel for her even now. Really, yeah. And of course, organ building used to take you away a lot as well. It used to take you to all sorts of weird places. Yeah, instead of some weird B&Bs. You know, weird B&Bs are up and down the country. You know, B&Bs where I had to roll myself into a cylinder to get through the door of my bedroom. All sorts of stuff like that. You know, there was one place we stayed. I think it was in Chichester. We worked at the cathedral. There was a knock on the door at 2 a.m. and the daughter of the proprietor of the hotel, you know, got there and tried to seduce me. I nearly succeeded. You know, all sorts of stuff like that. And it also told you about all about people and the way people behave, that sort of stuff as well. And that sort of stuck in me, you know, all that. It was a real life, really. And also, I lived in this, I had no money at all. because organ builders never earn any money either. The whole thing was, I was living on a shoestring, really. Sometimes I used to, you know, struggle around under the bed for loose change to buy myself a loaf of bread at the end of the week. Yeah. But that tells you an awful lot as well. Yeah. I came here to Italy for a year and did some work experience with the people here. This is actually the same village where I'm actually living now. And then I came back and I got a bit disillusioned with organ building because, again, the pay was terrible and everything else. I loved it. But at the same time, it was a bit sort of, I thought there might be some other things in the world I wanted to discover, really. So I left, and a neighbor of mine I lived at the Angel in Islington at the time, was a firework operator, and he sort of put on displays. He was sort of slowly sort of guy, a very nice guy, Ben Gaskell. He's a nice guy. He's a bit of a Sloan, and he knew lots of Sloaney people, and he'd started this firework company. And I knew he was a firework man because there were sorts of mortars and sort of rocket stands and things on his doorstep at the Angel Islington. I just knocked on his door one day and said, "Are you a firework operator? And the next day you do, can I come along and see what you do?" He said, "Yes, sure, Andrew, yes, of course. So I went along, and the first show we did was the Marchioness of Chumley at a great big Staley home in Norfolk. And we did that, and then we did the opening of the Design Museum in London for Terence Conran, who was a friend of his as well.
Wow.
And a lot of really interesting things. The opening of the appeal to save the Albert Memorial. We did an enormous letter, Save Albert, across the width of Hyde Park in fireworks. And then he decided he wanted to do something else. He was also an expert on Madagascar. So he wanted to trade in rock crystal and things from Madagascar. So he did that, and he sold me the company for almost nothing. I bought the kit and the contact list and everything. I invested in a bit of technology, did a bit of marketing and stuff. I didn't have any money still. I had nothing left at all after my organ building experience. And went from there, and it sort of worked, really. The first thing, big thing I landed was I was appointed one of the design team on the fireworks at Disneyland Paris. I just wrote to them and said, "You need a firework person now rather than 2 years' time." And they said, "Yes, well, we're actually putting a team together right now. So consider yourself appointed." So I was put to work with two French firework people who I knew, I now know very well as friends, Pierre-Alain Hubert, who used to travel the world doing this sort of stuff, and Daniel Azagot, who used to do he did just before, a few years before, all the big shows from Jean-Michel Jarre. And he's in his workshop in just outside Paris. There was all the old Jarre special effects stuff, even the giant mirror balls, the 3 meter wide mirror balls, these are all there. And I had meetings with him, and I worked with him when we'd done the opening at Disneyland Paris. I worked with him on a few other things, including a show in the Caribbean and stuff, which is very interesting too. That attracted a lot of publicity, and I didn't have to advertise it at all. The thing about doing something like that is the press do all your work for you.
Right.
You don't have to tell anybody. You don't have to take out ads saying, "We've done this show, and we, you know, look at us now," and everything else. I didn't have to do anything. All of the newspapers, like the Evening Standard and the Times and everything, did all the work for us. Yeah. They just wanted it because it was something unusual and interesting. It generated lots of articles, and we went from there. And so we landed things like, you know, we did shows for Microsoft, the 10th anniversary of Microsoft, stuff for British Charles, the opening West Country Television, where we had to fire some stuff in the middle of the sea, and we got the tide tables wrong. We up to our balls in seawater. The opening Canary Wharf we did. We worked in Nigeria, the Caribbean, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, you know, and add a lot of other stuff in the sort of regular stuff in the UK, like sort of a lot of Sloaney weddings and things, which was quite a lot of fun. And we even did a divorce party, which is quite fun. A guy,
oh really, fantastic!
Like a hospital operator, and decided to invest £500,000 in a party to celebrate his divorce.
Wow. Did he invite his ex?
Oh, the ex was there. Yes, he was. Yes. That was incredible. Absolutely incredible. Yeah. And so, I remember the ex came afterwards and after the show, kissed me on the lips. Of course, now being a free woman, she could do what she wanted. And anyway, that was a lot. That was an enormous thing. There was a sort of, in the 80s, there was a sort of air of astonishing optimism, really. Everyone thought they could do whatever they wanted because there was a sort of great road to prosperity ahead for everybody, really. And the sort of the money people spent and the sort of optimism of the whole era was extraordinary. I don't think the world will ever go back to that at all. I think that it was something in the era that's very special, really. And it's something that Maggie Thatcher gave us, and we can both thank her for and blame her for too, probably as well. She convinced the man on the street that he too could be a sort of capitalist. You know? Yeah. And if you could do that, you could do anything, really. Anyway.
But I have heard you also say, if you think advertising is cutthroat, try fireworks, people.
You should try fireworks, indeed. Yeah, so the fireworks people, other fireworks people were out to get you, really. Particularly when there was so much work and also towards the end when there was a recession, you know, in sort of 1991. People were very cutthroat, and even the people who you used to buy fireworks from, all the suppliers who bought the stuff through China and Japan and all sort of thing and sold it to people like me, even though you spent sort of 150, 200 grand a year with them, they started stabbing in the back. It was extraordinary. Yeah, they used to publish articles and send your clients letters saying that, don't use this guy again. He knows little about the organ building, the fireworks business. Yeah. Don't touch him with a barge pole. And this was a guy who used to take your money. Really. So it was extraordinary, really. And whenever you used to meet other firework people at trade fairs or something like that, you always used to sit there with your arms folded as if you were sort of on guard against each other. Really. Extraordinary. Much more cutthroat than we're also much more sort of catty, a bit bitchy. Really,
right?
Much more than advertising people.
This strikes me as, I've learned a couple of things from this, and it does kind of is reinforced by the research we've done. So, number one, I can tell you were a very sought after man. Must have been quite an attractive fella.
Yes.
Back then. There seems to be stories revolving around.
Yes, I don't know where I am now. Yes.
I didn't mean to suggest otherwise. But also, I wonder. Like it sounds quite frantic. I wonder how that compared to your early life ahead of going on this whirlwind from the age of 16 as an apprentice. Is this the type of life you led and you was inevitable, or did you catch a wave at the age of 16?
Not at all. I called it very much caught a wave because I had a very sort of subdued childhood, really.
Right.
I had a father who was a very, very bright guy. He's still alive, so I can't say anything horrible about him at all, but I do love him dearly. But he sort of convinced me a little bit that I wasn't fit for very much, really. I felt slightly sort of repressed in a way as a kid. I didn't say very much. It was very quiet.
He thought you'd make a good window cleaner, I've read.
He said I thought I'd make a good window cleaner, exactly. And that was sort of, I thank him for that in a way, because he was sort of, that was the incentive for doing all the, probably one of the incentives for doing so much, as much as I've done.
Yes.
To sort of try, not to prove him wrong as a person, because, he was, I think he was very intelligent in saying that, really, in a way, because I think he probably knew I'd react to it. Yeah. And he was, he's a very nice, we get on much better now. We didn't then, I couldn't wait to go to work. I left home at 3 days after my 16th birthday. I couldn't wait to get away because I just knew that, there was this other world waiting for me, and I was sort of told that I'm by nature I'm actually quite quiet and reserved and very polite and not very forthcoming in a funny sort of way, and that was me as a kid, really. And then all of a sudden I left home and just opened up.
And you say advertising was your third career, so I feel like we've touched on two. How did the third career start?
Well, when the firework company came to an end quite suddenly because we did a show at Eton College. We had an accident. A stray shell went caught a gust of wind up the top somewhere and came down in the crowd. And I burnt the two supermodels in the audience got burnt. And it left a very bitter taste in my mouth. We were fully insured and we were fully compliant with everything. It's one of the reasons why we used to spend $35,000 a year on insurance in the 80s.
Wow.
That's a lot of money. But it just left a bitter taste in my mouth, and something, it sort of stayed with me for such a long time that I had to get out of it, really. So I sold up, really. And I thought, what am I going to do now? You know, I didn't know anybody in advertising. I didn't know anything in advertising at all. Nothing at all. But it just sounded fun. I've seen a couple of copies of Campaign on some firework class desks. I thought, what is this game about? You know, I knew nothing about it at all. You know, it might be people in big glasses and suits, or it might be, you know, in those days it was, or people, there were lots of creative people who wore black, you know, or people who drank lots of martinis. I have no idea. Oh, this was actually pre-Mad Men or anything, you know. So I didn't know anything about it at all. So what I did was, this was before the internet, of course, and before everything. So I went and hand-wrote 50 letters to 50 creative directors in London, wrote them by hand and sent them off, and I got three replies back. One from Axel Childercott, who I haven't been in touch with for an awful long time, and he thought I was absolutely barking mad. But this is how you do it. He said, go and buy yourselves a layout pad and some markers and do some ads. This is called your book. Now, then you take it around. The second person was Chris O'Shea, who helped me an awful lot in the early days. And I couldn't wish for a nicer guy to help me. The third one was Patrick Collister at Ogilvy. And he sent me a copy test. And he was one of the last creative directors, probably in London, probably in the world, I don't know, to use a copy test as a sort of gauge of people before they joined. And I did a copy test. I also did a very bad portfolio as well. Terrible, terrible work, which I don't know. I've got some of the ads still in my drawer somewhere here. And you know, I wouldn't show them to anybody. Even an example of how not to do it. And he gave me a shot. I told him I want you to be as brutal as you want to be. I don't want you to be nice and polite or you know, things. Just if it's shit, say so and tell me how to improve, because that's the only way I'm going to learn, you know. And so he gave me a shot for a fortnight. And in that fortnight, I was lucky to meet some other people at Ogilvy. There was a guy called Nick Parton who had just finished doing, this takes me back a bit. He had finished doing the Don't Rough It, Live Life in Comfort campaign, which was taking the world by storm, and he won him lots of awards and other things. He said, you know, come and sit with me, be my writer for a bit and let's see how it goes. And we worked on lots of things. We worked on Huggies and all sorts of stuff like that. And I, bit by bit, you know, I just learned by osmosis, really. And just every day I picked people's brains. And I said to everyone, you know, just say what you think of what I'm doing. You know, don't try and be all nice. You know, I can take it. I've done two careers as well where people have been horrible sometimes. So to be horrible if you want. Don't mince your words, really. Okay. Those 2 weeks then turned into 2 months, then turned into how many years? 5 years.
I was going to say, I mean, I'm a huge believer in, and I know you are too, that you know, good people know a lot of stuff about stuff, and that happens from other careers and your experience ahead of joining the advertising industry.
Yes.
But the other angle I hadn't really considered is just, not only was it really nice for Patrick to give you that 2 weeks, but relative to someone pouring a pint of glue down your pants, he must have been an angelic.
Well, it was angelic, but the thing is, people were very nice, but very tough as well, you know.
Okay.
And you know, I remember going to one person's office in Ogilvy, and some people, he was probably pissed as well. I don't know. He just took all the work out of my portfolio, scrambled it up, and put it in the bin. I said, start again. I think if you did that to somebody these days, a young person these days, they'd be offended and take you to HR.
Yes.
In those days, and you know, having done an apprenticeship with a bunch of old bastards and you know, in a workshop, it was second nature to me. I didn't mind that at all. It was like starting again at another apprenticeship.
Yeah. And was it quite evident to you, at least, that you had an advantage of understanding people from all walks of life?
I think so. Very, very much. Very, very much indeed. I think having done the two things I did before put me on a very good stead, really, for many reasons, really. First of all, you learn how people tick. The second thing is I think I've always believed that only real experiences turn into ideas, turn into great ideas, really. And this is the thing, the sort of slight grungy thing I have about the internet. Although we use it every day, and it's a fantastic reference library and everything else, but it's a bit like a vending machine. It gives you what you ask for. And you don't stumble on things by accident. And you don't stumble on experiences by accident and turn into things. The things that surprise you in life, the things you actually encounter just by accident, and the things that stay in your head and staying things will actually eventually become a thought and maybe an idea. Okay. And I think we've robbed ourselves a little bit of that by overusing one resource, and that's the internet. Okay. I think that you said something that to me when you briefed me on this. There's a huge value in people understanding that talented people don't always step out of shiny college uni straight into a shiny career. Absolutely right. You shouldn't even try doing that, really. I think social media and the media itself, pressures people into sort of needing to do things the right way from, the right way from the very start, And the fact there's no room for error, there's no room for mistakes, You always read stories about this guy who was a millionaire at 13, or, I landed my first record deal when I was still at school. Aren't that great? And everybody sees that as a benchmark and will try and emulate that and try and be perfect and try not to screw up from the very early times. That's not right at all, really. I think you learn by your screw-ups. I think you learn more by your mistakes and what you get wrong than if you just follow a set of rules, really. I can't see the point, really. Yeah, but social media is very easy to follow that because, it's a funnel. It drags you in. We now have a whole lot of young people who are just trying to emulate each other rather than emulate what's around them, I think. And it's an enormous difference, and something that actually worries me a little bit too, sometimes occasionally too.
If I may, I'd like to go back to your quote just now that the internet is like a vending machine. And I almost wish that I had a conversation earlier today with someone who runs a research company. And I wish I had had the conversation with her after we'd had this conversation, because I think I was trying to articulate something about discovery,
yes,
about people in the advertising context that you can only really get when you spend time with those people rather than you ask specific questions,
yes,
in a survey. Same reason, you can't discover anything because you're writing the question. So you're...
No, I think the internet has enlightened our lives in many, many ways, and it's great. And, we all use it, and I love it every day. But it's robbed us a little bit of the joy of the real tangible joy of discovery.
Yes,
I think.
Yeah, discovery is the word. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you tend only to retain knowledge. You retain things you see if you make an effort to learn them in the first place. So it sounds really old fashioned. This sounds really old farty to say, but I mean, whenever you wanted to know something, you used to go to a library. The very effort of going to the library, and finding the department and asking the girl at the desk and finding the things you wanted, okay, was the incentive to actually go and learn what you were there to look up. Okay?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what they call the IKEA effect these days.
That's right, the IKEA effect. That's right, exactly. That's exactly what it is. And I think, it sounds really fuddy-duddy, I know, and I don't mean this at all. It almost sounds as if it's almost too easy to access things. And if you make things too easy to access, they become passive. And you don't take them in at all.
Yeah. It's a really good point.
Yeah. And it's a really interesting thing. Yeah. It's a really thing. I mean, somebody said to me the other day here, in fact, in garbled Italian, that to say, how come we've got all, we can access everything, every bit of knowledge there is in the world or something. Yet we seem to know even that, but less than we did.
Yeah.
And it's true because we don't really have to work things out anymore.
Well, I think that works like the other way you look at it. Perhaps if we're and I'm trying to, in a very clumsy way, it would seem, get onto the subject of craft, because my quote I used about you talking about craft was about signalling and how if someone spent time on it, it means something to you.
Yes.
Rather than if you spend time trying to acquire information, it tends to stick more. But it works both angles, doesn't it?
It works both ways, exactly. Craft is the thing, because, you know, despite what a lot of people think, the consumer, you know, David Ogilvy was right. You know, the consumer is not an idiot. She's all right. You know. And something I actually still believe in now, really, consumers should be treated, you know, as intelligent human beings. They should be challenged. At every opportunity, and they rise to it. You know, and any consumer can tell the difference between a crafted ad and one that's been generated by somebody hitting a key. All consumers are literate. They can spell. They can appreciate the beauty of something incredibly visual or well written. You know, if they didn't do that, we wouldn't have art galleries or books. You know, people, you know, it's you know, the fact that people read books and more newspapers, I think, are a sign that people are literate, you know, and appreciate writing. So to assume that they don't, and assume that they need to be spelt, have everything spelt out in front of them in the most inane, sort of watered down, pap version possible, you know, is actually not giving, you know, it's not doing us any favors, really. You know, the old adage was that you should always let the consumer complete the circle whenever you communicate with them. And you should always credit them with that, you know, because, you know, it's not that we're not us and them. We're more and more as an industry talking to ourselves rather than the people we work for. Communication is done with care. Say a brand takes care, and it doesn't matter whether it's a tin of baked beans or a dental service or a Harley Street surgeon. It doesn't matter at all. People can recognize the fact that you've taken care of something and you've crafted something. You can apply the same thing to print and traditional media versus digital as well. Consumers know that it's easier to generate a digital ad. People know that.
I saw a great retort a few weeks ago, which I have subsequently shared online, from someone talking about people who use ChatGPT or any other AI tool to write their copy.
Yeah.
And it was, why should I bother to read something that nobody was bothered to write?
That's what a lovely throat. Yeah, well, I think, if you don't mind, I'm going to steal that somewhere.
Do it. Steal it. It's wonderful. But for the same reason. And do you think that your time as an apprentice, and I don't know whether organ builders regard themselves as craftsmen, obviously there's craft of sorts to a very high level. Do you think that's something that you arrived with when you started in advertising?
I very much understood the sort of the importance of taking care, really, because if you make an organ, you want it to last for 200 years. And so what we do in advertising, you make something which is going to last in people's mind. It doesn't last physically, because it, you know, if you do run a print ad, it's going to be wrapping somebody's fish and chips next week. Right. Okay. Physically, it doesn't exist. It won't exist after that. But it will, if you aim for it to be last longer in people's minds, you know, enough for people to mention it over a conversation in a pub or whistle a jingle in a bus queue, or you know, to bring it up in conversation when you're a little bit pissed over Sunday lunch, and you know, so do you remember that ad from last week? Oh, that was really funny. Christ, it went like this, you know. People saw. If you give people the material to remember, then of course they'll remember it. Easy.
Yeah, when you talk about craft, you don't. Am I right in thinking you don't necessarily just mean the final execution of the idea? You mean the whole process?
Whole process, yeah. Down to the line, you know, I'm a writer. Down to the last, but I'm maybe a little bit obsessive about it. I don't have no idea at all. Ask someone like Steve Harrison or Will Audrey, you know, and they'll probably tell you how, you know. I tend to be, even things like punctuation and little things like that. But I do the same when I write. I'm terrible, really. I do the same when I write texts, and do email. I can't send a really terrible email to somebody which is badly crafted, because at the end of the day, if I write to even write to a client to say, you know, to say something, and it's badly written, it's a bit of my writing. That's exactly it's and if I text the client saying I'm going to be late for a meeting or something like that, then I have to craft it because it's another bit of writing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you find that we have to, the clients, I suppose unfairly for those of us who believe in craft, do you find that it's unfair how weighted it is, in as much as we almost need to convince people that it's justifiable?
Yes, they do, really. And I think a lot of it, part of our remit as advertising people, I think we should educate clients as well as everybody else. Because it's them that buy what we write, if that's to begin with, really. And if they had a better understanding of the of its importance, and it's very easy to thing to bring over. If I can convince somebody that to care is to show you care, then it's easy to impart on other people. So I think we should run a few little courses or evolve our clients to a slightly deeper level, really. In the sense, we don't just sell them stuff. We tell them why we're doing it, and if we need to refer to it or take them somewhere where the creative inspiration comes from, or show them examples of better writing. Now, I occasionally send my clients books. You know, if I enjoy a novel, I'll send one to someone I'm writing for. Yeah, because this is how we were talking about strong sentences the other day, and you know, here's a bit of him. Okay, it just reminded me of something by Ian McEwan. Yeah, I thought you'd like a copy. There's a lot of sort of shoveling going on, a lot of stuff that gets written. That's shoveled on without any explanations and that sort of thing. And that reminds me a little bit what something that Steve Harrison said to me. Always try and present or sell by face-to-face rather than just sticking it on an email and sending it to somebody. Because then you've got this understanding, you have this chemistry between you that allows you to explain to each other why you're doing what you're doing. Right? Anyway. I'm sounding a bit like an accountant now. That's terrible. Let's get something more creative.
I could ask you to unpack that and send a few Excel people.
Please don't.
did you work with Steve?
I did. Yeah, I worked for him briefly when he had the office in Greek Street when it was Harrison Trout and Wonderman.
Right. Okay.
He was a real inspiration. I love him to bits, really. Steve, I think if Steve would agree with me that he's an acquired taste, and things. I love his work. I mean, I love some of the direct mail he's done. It's absolutely lovely, you know, because it's so no nonsense and not superfluous and to the point and on ball all the time. That lovely work you probably remember he did for the AA about 20 years ago, which was this lovely cardboard signs he used to hang up, used to hold by the roadside when you car broke down. You just send a whole load of those to people as a piece of direct mail. So if you don't have the, you're going to need this. What a beautiful bit of thought. It's a really...
genius.
It's a very sort of linear piece of thinking without any flaws in it, really, which ends up in a surprise, which is lovely.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of Steve. I actually talk to Steve quite regularly. And I've been fortunate enough that he's been on the show a couple of times and even interviewed me on this, which is great. But I think he would 100% agree that he's an acquired taste, and I feel that's always been part of Steve. But that's great. I wasn't aware.
No, but he's very much a person that I very much have a lot of time for, really, indeed.
So where did advertising take you? Because you're still obviously practicing, you're still writing.
Very much so, yes. So it took me from Ogilvy, I did about 2.5 years, I think, in a BBH with Will Audrey. That's how I met Will Audrey. And then I think BBS got fed up with me because I wasn't trendy enough. I can't remember what the reason was. But anyway, I left there and freelanced for a little bit, and I had my own agency for a little bit for 2 or 3 years. Well, just called Andrew Jolliffe, and we specialised in British food. And our first client was the National Farmers Union, and we did all that work for all the work to promote the red tractor and that sort of thing, which is all quite fun. But it was hard work. I'm a better creative than I'm a businessman by a long way, really. And the business side of it really got to me. I didn't I couldn't do it very well, to be honest. I didn't know anything about building the right teams or anything as well. So it didn't sort of go belly up or anything. I just decided to give it a rest because it was what I realized very quickly was my big passion was writing rather than making sure we had enough turnover to pay everybody or anything.
Yeah.
So I sort of, but it was a lot of fun. We got some, what we did for the NFU was quite a lot of fun. To promote the Red Tractor, we even did things like design the press conferences and that sort of thing. We had all the journalists wait through a field of wheat once, I remember, to get to the podiums. And things. It was a lot of fun. Yeah. So we put a bit of theatre in every single thing we did. We also worked for an ice cream brand and a kitchen brand and a few other things, which is a lot of fun. It was very small. I sort of got at this. I went back to Ogilvy for 18 months as a group head on American Express, which was astonishingly stressful, because Amex is a bastard brand really to work with. Really, it's really really tricky because it's a very interesting brand, but it's very hard because some bits of it are so definable, I think. And then I left and my first wife and I, then we just bought a little apartment in Paris. We went over to see, and I thought, just out of curiosity, I thought, I'll just see what the advertising scene is in Paris. And because I didn't know anything about it. And I went to the Ogilvy office, just out of chance, and I bumped into a lady called Susan Westrup, who's now retired, who ran IBM from Paris, the whole of Europe, for the whole of Europe. And I met her. We just got on like a house on fire. She said, well, Susan, why don't you come and work here? So I did. My original sort of few weeks in Paris turned into 13 years.
Wow.
Yeah. I did 10 years at Ogilvy Paris, became head of copy. We did nearly all my creative awards I won in Paris, because it was a bit like stepping back in time, because London, by the time I left London, it all became a little bit it was becoming very a little bit online and a little bit more starchy and a little bit more constricted. Going to Paris, Ogilvy Paris, is a bit like Ogilvy London probably was in the 70s. So it was going back to the old school, really, a little bit. And still full of, still sort of old ages of politics and that sort of thing, but also very, very French as well.
What interests me specifically about that and what you've said, with a nod to Ogilvy, and it's an answer you have given, and I should do you credit. It's not an absolute answer. You gave three answers to this question when you described your dream client.
Yes.
But one of them you said is the most obscure, tiny, hidden, unintelligible, squinky little brand with a world-saving product. They'll let me do anything to sell. Now, I similarly have a maybe unhealthy obsession with those types of brands, and they're my dream client also. But I wonder how many of those would ever approach Ogilvy rather than go to a smaller independent.
None whatsoever, because they know they can't afford them.
Yeah.
I had an idea. I put an idea once to be when I was at BBH. I remember when we were at BBH, we all were asked to think of ideas to where we could take the business afterwards, and people suggested let's start a record label and let's open a theatre and that's all, which is all very nice as well, because I had this idea as well to do for doing live ads in theatres as well. In fact, started a partnership with Eardrum to do that, but it never went anywhere for some reason. I don't know why. I'll try it again one day. The thing I suggested was we launch Baby BBH using the same skills and the same skill sets and the same methods and the same ways of doing things as the big BBH, but only on a tiny scale for people who want to be big BBH clients in the future. And it went down like a cup of cold sick. For some reason, I have no idea why. I think it was probably the wrong time, because I think if you suggested it now, I think it might fly. I think circumstances have changed, and the attitude towards brand growth and all the other stuff that people talk about is all different. So I think, and also with the sort of job market as it is, I think you'll if you gave creatives a chance to work on small things as well. Everybody wants to work on Nike and Levi's and Coke. The people who really do the work, I think I did a blog on this once a couple of years ago, about the people who are the real heroes of this business are the growers rather than the sort of perpetuators, really. The people who grow stuff from nothing. I love the challenge too of taking a brand who's nobody at all, at the moment, and with also probably not the resources to employ anyone big at all, and see where they go. Because what they can do is put themselves in your hands completely and say, take me somewhere exciting, okay? Time, weather, and...
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. But we have asked, got one here from a chap who I believe you know well, Theo Erasmus.
Oh, yes.
Well, Theo asks, is there a better way to prepare for this crazy business?
It is, yes, I think that steers me straight back to where we started, I think, is that do even more before you do it, before you go in. Don't just go from university and learn about advertising and then get a job. Do something else first. It's a bit like being in government, really. I think all MPs in England should do at least one thing before they become MPs. It's the same thing,
yeah.
Really. Do anything you want, even just for a short time. Before you try to get your first placement or first job in advertising, go and be a bricklayer for 6 months. Go and dig graves. Go and work in a hospital. Go and do something else. Work in a kitchen. Help a chef. Do anything else. Do anything you like. Do something else. That will be your best. That will be your best education. That will be your best preparation. For what's to come.
Yeah, yeah. It would certainly help avoid the sort of cookie cutter
model we seem
to have. Yeah. I like it's funny actually, and I might be going off topic slightly here, but my brother and I went to university, but he took a year out before going to university and had a proper job, and he was, washing dishes and all sorts, anything he could do to earn a living.
Yeah.
And I always noticed during our time at university, albeit in different cities, that he seemed to have a greater respect for the work that would follow with graduation. Whereas to me, I still was entirely ignorant to the real world at that stage. Admittedly, I had student jobs and so on. But yeah, I think just having that exposure and having that front line in whatever war you're fighting or career you're in is vital.
A few years ago now, I used to coach quite a lot of people from the Miami Ad School. I wrote a presentation for them, for budding writers. And it was just basically a sort of how-to, really. And the last thing is just a little chapter saying do. It's just a list of stuff. I'll give you 10. Just so I know we're short of time. Okay. It just says chapter 9 do, like go to the opera, walk Niagara Falls, meet the Queen, work in a soup kitchen, go and see some mental patients, get crush a royal garden party, date a nuclear physicist, shag an actor or actress or actress's mistress. Go on to hear music you think you'll hate. Ice skate. Train falcons. Work on a cancer ward. Go hot tub ballooning. Anything except sit in a comfy chair, stare at a fucking screen, and see the same people every day.
Brilliant.
If anyone wants a copy of that little presentation I did, just tell them to get in touch with me on LinkedIn or something, and I'll send them one with pleasure.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, excellent. And question two we've had is from Kirsty Lane. Kirsty says, given the ratio of work to reward isn't perhaps what it was, how can we convince young creative talent to stick around? I think she's nodding to the exodus of the industry. Or perhaps we're maybe not as attractive as we once were as an industry, maybe.
Yeah, we're not as attractive as we once were as an industry. I think that it's a bit of a curveball in a way, really. Right, okay. I think it's easy. I think we need to make it fun again. Yeah. we need to have fun. We need to, it's not just, I'm not suggesting we go back to the 80s and sort of, you know, get drunk every night and, you know, make love on the tables like people used to do in the 80s. But we ought to, it's become, agencies particularly have become very sort of process driven, very sort of very formulaic in the way they do things. They've become a little bit of a factory in a way, really. People, if anywhere really, it's not just an ad agency. If a place is interesting to work, an interesting place to work, then those people will stay. And as simple as that, really. The other thing I think, where the thing I just go back to where I was when I said about educating clients. If clients bought more great work, people would be more enthused to stay around and write more of it. Okay, it's as simple as that. You know, that's not rocket science either, really. You know, if we, I think a lot of it is about how agencies and people work with clients. I think if we give them stuff, just like a shop or a vending machine, then that's what they're going to start expecting, and that's what they won't buy anything else. Right? So it's our responsibility to actually change that in a way. It's not, we all sort of sit there and curse clients and that sort of thing. But in fact, clients maybe secretly down their bowels curse us too, in the sense that, you know, well, if they want, you know, what do they mean about good work? What do they mean about good creative work? What do they mean about craft and copy? Sort of thing. We don't know either. So what do they tell us? Well, we should.
I'll tell you, that's a brilliant answer. And I also think you're absolutely bang on. We need to take responsibility for fixing any ills rather than...
I think we do. I think we hang around the spat on platforms on LinkedIn and things, and we blame people, I think. And a lot of it's down to us.
Right. Yeah, really. And you know, to really show my hand, I've definitely been that guy. But it took me a few years to realise that actually we can change things if we just...
We can change things if we want to. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the final part of the interview, Andrew, is our four pertinent poses that we put to all of our guests. Starting with, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Do even more before you go in, I think. I'm sort of beating around this like a sort of, you know, like a sort of banshee in a way. But it's very, very true. I think there are one or two more things I wish I'd done. I sort of wish sometimes I've been to university and things, but I haven't. I might do it later in life. I think I might do it when I'm 80 or something, just for fun.
I'll do it. If you do, can you let me know so I can enroll on the same course?
I think it'd be fun. Because... There's also a bit of, you know, there's also the social side of university, which I never got either. You know, so It's about meeting people and things. My sister and I were very different in that respect. My sister went to Cambridge and she did medicine, and she's now a sort of professor of dermatology. And she met a lot of our colleagues and things are still our old mates from Cambridge and that sort of thing. So I think that's it's quite helpful, not just from a sort of nepotistic point of view. I think that's a wrong way of looking at it. I think it's a question of, I'm meeting the same, similar people of my same mindset, really. I had a lot of trouble when I was younger, mixing with ordinary people who hadn't done quite as much as I had, and convincing them that was the right thing to do. And of course, everyone just wanted to sort of, you know, do less and chill and, you know, hang around and smoke dope or whatever they wanted to do. You know, I wasn't into that at all. I was into doing stuff. And I was very, and I think from university probably might have been good for me in retrospect.
Well, it still might be. So
I think so. Yeah.
My only concern, if you were to go to university now, and I say this with the greatest respect to university lecturers, but I feel like you might be significantly disappointed with the people that you're meant to be learning from.
Maybe.
You might not be as well. That could be really unfair.
I think everywhere I go, I look for inspirational figures. Really, and it's a bit sad, but sometimes I meet less and less these days than this before.
Okay. Yeah. Number two, then, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
Can I say something that the industry needs rather than what was to banish from it?
Yeah, let's be more positive. Do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's, again, what I was saying before, education for clients.
Okay.
Yeah, compulsory, sort of, not just sort of why we do what we do at XXX agency, about what creativity does to minds and people's way of life and people and how it affects people I think. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's excellent. Number three, are there any books that you can recommend to our listeners? And they needn't be business books. They can
be anything. No, they're not business books. They're two. Yeah, I've thought about this as well. There's two novelists who I think everyone should read. First of all, I think the one you know very well is probably Ian McEwan. Because he writes very visually. And if you want to write good copy or radio ads or anything, then you need something which is tech copy, which is going to partly take you to another place, really, and put you in another, especially if you're writing radio. You know, radio is not literal. It should take you to another world, and to onto the open road or into another town or to another planet or whatever. And just like a radio play. And you need writing that does that for you. And I think he's lovely. You know, I love his books. I read them over and over again. Yes, but it's a bit risque, some of it. And some of it, you know, again, it's sort of, maybe the wokest amongst us all will say it's a bit below the belt and too sexual and it's too, you know. No, not at all. You should read it. It's very, the first few lines take you to another place. You know, every time you're in a field where a balloon's landing, you're in a school, you're in another country, you know, and then you go from there and you're there already. And then it's about to tell you the rest of the story. Fantastic. You know,
if they were going to choose one of his books, which one would you recommend?
Oh God. I think, one of the ones I enjoyed most of all was Saturday.
Okay.
Was about a brain surgeon who almost meets his nemesis with one of his patients.
Wow.
And I think it's very, very good. So a piece of McEwan, and anyone will do, really. One or two are a little bit risky. I mean, I love the things on Cement Garden, for example. It's very, very good. Again, if you're a bit squeamish about death and sort of childhood love and that sort of thing, just avoid it. But I like it because of its writing, the way it's written, and the way it takes you, really. And the other person who does something very similar, and an author who doesn't immediately ring a bell with a lot of people, there's an Irish guy called John McGahan, and he takes you to Dublin all the time, every time, into bars and into people's houses and people's family homes where people are having crises or love interests, or seeing people in secret trysts, that sort of thing, and hotel rooms, and that sort of thing. But you can, it immediately takes you there. You can, if he takes you into a hotel room in Dublin, for example, you can almost in the 80s, you can immediately smell the sort of the mold of the corridor, or the bathroom, or the dust on the carpet. A couple of industry books, I think, copy book by the NAD, I think a must. And if I can dare, can I give someone a tiny plug? I think
sure.
Steve Harrison's book, The Howard Gossage Show, which has just come out, is certainly worth a read, because Howard Gossage was, really, in a way, you know, although, you know, a lot of new guys would shun him, I don't at all, because the very principles of his communication are laid out for all to see in all everything he did.
So, absolutely.
I think I would do that. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, they're brilliant. We'll link to all of those. And in fact, I'll relink in this episode's listing to the show. We called it the Howard Gossage Show, but it was actually Steve himself and Dave Dye both came on. And I think the archive they have built from, let's face it, previously lost or relatively unseen work is
incredible.
Just incredible.
And it just, yeah. You know, the thing is, every bit of copy, everything that Howard Gossage wrote just raptured you.
Oh, incredible. No, I mean, and again, it's what frustrates me today when you look back at Gossage and how good he was at breaking category norms, and yet you still feel like you're having to debate that
Exactly.
Amazing. Well, these are brilliant books. And then number four, then, we always dedicate every episode to someone, and we bestow or hospital pass that honour, depending on your view, to our guest, yeah, who has to give the reason why. So would you do the honour?
Yes, of course. I think I've already introduced him, I think. My dad, I think, who gave me the incentive to do even more in my life than I was believed to be capable of.
Amazing. Fantastic. Well, this episode is very proudly dedicated to your dad. That's fantastic. So, Andrew, I've I've really enjoyed this episode. It's been a huge pleasure and a privilege. We're going to link to everything we've discussed, but how else can our listeners get more Andrew Jolliffe?
They can just get hold of me on LinkedIn. They can go to my website, which is ironic, not Andrew. It's not called Andrew Jolliffe, but they'll get there in the end if they do. It's called thedolliffe.com. And it's ironic. My site is designed, actually, it's a new site because it's entirely written by my client. I didn't write a word of it, apart from the work. I just had this idea that my clients probably are more believable. What my clients say is almost more believable than what I write. So there you go. Yeah, that was the idea. Yeah.
As a proof point of that, one of them says, he is crazy fun and sometimes he makes me say fuck. Very charming, but very firm. He says what he thinks is right, even if sometimes he'd better not and use more diplomacy. So yeah, amazing. So yeah, no, it's
yeah.
It's been honestly, I've really enjoyed this.
Thank
episode.
You very much. That's great. Absolutely fantastic. Thank you. And if anybody wants to get in touch, yes, do. If anyone wants a copy of the student thing I did, just tell them to get in touch. Lovely.
Yeah. Well,
thank you very much.
I mean, I will link to everything we've discussed. If there's anything else you want to throw in, this won't be coming out for a few weeks, so you can just email me, Andrew, and I'll make sure. If you're listening to this now on whatever podcast channel you are, then check this listing because all of those links will be there. Finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do share and review the pod. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online, or you can email the mouthful that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I try, I can't get no a call to action. Oh, I can't get no a call to action. Yeah.